Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. This is a Design for Living Big Book meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. My name is Debbie and I am a compulsive overeater and bulimic and your chairperson for today. To open the meeting, let us have a moment of quiet meditation followed by the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. We start this meeting by remembering our common purpose to extend the heart and hand of the OA Fellowship to those who still suffer. Let us be mindful of OA's unity with diversity policy, which respects our differences, yet unites us in the solution to our common problem. Whatever problem you may have with food, you are welcome at this meeting. Today, we are delighted to have Cara join us to share her experience, strength, and hope focused on the topic of gratitude in action. I'm very happy to be welcoming Cara. We will start with the reading first. We're going to do two paragraphs each.
The story of David B., one of the founders of AA in Canada in 1944. I believe it would be good to tell the story of my life. Doing so will give me the opportunity to remember that I must be grateful to God and to those members of Alcoholics Anonymous who knew AA before me. Telling my story reminds me that I could go back to where I was if I forget the wonderful things that have been given to me or forget that God is the guide who keeps me on this path. In June 1924, I was 16 years old and had just graduated from high school in Sherbrooke, Quebec. Some of my friends suggested that we go for a beer. I had never had beer or any other form of alcohol. I don't know why, since we always had alcohol at home. I should add that no one in my family was ever considered an alcoholic. Well, I was afraid my friends wouldn't like me if I didn't do as they did. I knew firsthand that mysterious state of people who appear to be sure of themselves but are actually eaten alive with fear inside. I had a rather strong inferiority complex. I believe I lacked what my father used to call character. So on that nice summer day in an old inn in Sherbrooke, I didn't find the courage to say no.
I became an active alcoholic from that first day when alcohol produced a very special effect in me. I was transformed. Alcohol suddenly made me into what I always wanted to be. Alcohol became my everyday companion. At first, I considered it a friend. Later, it became a heavy load I couldn't get rid of. It turned out to be much more powerful than I was, even if for many years I could stay sober for short periods. I kept telling myself that one way or another, I would get rid of alcohol. I was convinced I would find a way to stop drinking. I didn't want to acknowledge that alcohol had become so important in my life. Indeed, alcohol was giving me something I didn't want to lose.
In 1934, a series of mishaps occurred because of my drinking. I had to come back from Western Canada because the bank I worked for lost confidence in me. An elevator accident cost me all of the toes on one foot and a skull fracture. I was in the hospital for months. My excessive drinking also caused a brain hemorrhage, which completely paralyzed one side of my body. I probably did my first step the day I came by ambulance to Western Hospital. A night shift nurse asked me, "Mr. B, why do you drink so much? You have a wonderful wife, a bright little boy. You have no reason to drink like that. Why do you?" Being honest, for the first time I said, "I don't know, nurse. I really don't know." That was many years before I learned about the fellowship. You might think I'd tell myself, if alcohol causes so much harm, I will stop drinking. But I found countless reasons to prove to myself that alcohol had nothing to do with my misfortunes. I told myself it was because of fate, because everyone was against me, because things weren't going well. I sometimes thought that God did not exist. I thought, if this loving God exists, as they say, he would not treat me this way. God would not act like this. I felt very sorry for myself a lot in those days.
My family and employers were concerned about my drinking, but I had become rather arrogant. I bought a 1931 Ford with an inheritance from my grandmother, and my wife and I made a trip to Cape Cod. On the way back, we stopped at my uncle's place in New Hampshire. His uncle had taken me under his wing at the time of my mother's death, and he worried about me. Now he said to me, "Dave, if you stop drinking for a full year, I will give you the Ford Roadster I just bought." I love the car, so I immediately promised I wouldn't drink for a whole year, and I meant it. Yet I was drinking again before we reached the Canadian border. I was powerless over alcohol. I was learning that I could do nothing to fight it off, even while I was denying the fact. On Easter weekend, 1944, I found myself in a jail cell in Montreal. By now, I was drinking to escape the horrible thoughts I had whenever I was sober enough to become aware of my situation. I was drinking to avoid seeing what I had become. The job I'd had for 20 years and the new car were long gone. I had undergone 3 stays in a psychiatric hospital. God knows I didn't want to drink, yet to my great despair, I always returned to the infernal merry-go-round.
I wondered how this misery would end. I was full of fear. I was afraid to tell others what I felt, lest they would think I was insane. I was terribly lonely, full of self-pity and terrified. Most of all, I was in a deep depression. Then I recalled a book given to me by my sister Jean about drunks as desperate as I was, who had found a way to stop drinking. According to this book, these drunks had found a way to live like other human beings, to get up in the morning, go to work, and return home in the evenings. This book was about Alcoholics Anonymous. I decided to get in touch with them. I had much difficulty in reaching AA in New York, as AA wasn't as well known then. I finally spoke to a woman, Bobby, who said words I hope I never forget. "I'm an alcoholic. We have recovered. If you want, we'll help you." She told me about herself and added that many other drunks had used this method to stop drinking. What impressed me most in this conversation was the fact that these people, 500 miles away, cared enough to try to help me. Here I was feeling so sorry for myself, convinced that no one cared whether I was dead or alive.
I was very surprised when I got a copy of the big book in the mail the following day. And each day after that, for nearly a year, I got a letter or a note, something from Bobby or from Bill or one of the other members of the central office in New York. In October 1944, Bobby wrote, "You sound very sincere, and from now on, we will be counting on you to perpetuate the fellowship of AA where you are. You will find enclosed some queries from alcoholics. We think you are now ready to take on this responsibility." She had enclosed some 400 letters that I answered in the course of the following weeks. Soon I began to get answers back. In my new enthusiasm and having found an answer to my problem, I told Dory, my wife, "You can quit your job now. I will take care of you. From now on, you will take the place you deserve in this family." However, she knew better. She said, "No, Dave, I will keep my job for a year while you go save the drunks." That is exactly what I set out to do.
As I look back on it now, I did everything wrong, but at least I was thinking of somebody else instead of myself. I had begun to get a little bit of something I am very full of now, and that is gratitude. I was becoming increasingly grateful to the people in New York and to the God they referred to, but whom I found difficult to reach. Yet I realized I had to seek the higher power I was told about. I was all alone in Quebec at that time. The Toronto group had been in operation since the previous fall, and there was a member in Windsor who attended meetings across the river in Detroit. That was AA in its entirety in this country.
I was all alone. Oh, I'm sorry. One day I got a, is that right?
Yeah.
One day, thanks, I got a letter from a man in Halifax who wrote, "One of my friends, a drunk, works in Montreal, but he is currently in Chicago, where he went on a major binge. When he returns to Montreal, I'd like you to talk to him." I met this man at his home His wife was cooking dinner, their young daughter at her side. The man was wearing a velvet jacket and sitting comfortably in his parlor. I hadn't met many people from high society. I immediately thought, what's going on here? This man isn't an alcoholic. Jack was a down-to-earth person. He was used to discussions about psychiatry, and the concept of a higher power didn't appeal to him very much. But from our meeting, AA was born here in Quebec.
Fellowship started to grow, most particularly following the publicity we got in the Gazette in the spring of 1945. I will never forget the day that Mary came to see me. She was the first woman to join our fellowship here. She was very shy and reserved, very low-key. She had heard of the fellowship through the Gazette. For the first year, all the meetings were held in my home. There were people all over the house. The wives of members used to come with their husbands, though we didn't allow them in our closed meetings. They used to sit on the bed or in the kitchen where they would make coffee and snacks. I believe they were wondering what would happen to us, yet they were as happy as we were.
The first two French Canadians to learn about AA did so in the basement of my home. All French-speaking meetings in existence today were born out of those early meetings. At the end of my first year of sobriety, my wife agreed to leave her job after I found some work. I thought that would be easy. All I had to do was go see an employer, and I'd be able to support my family in a normal fashion. However, I looked for work for many months. We didn't have much money, and I was spending the little we had going from one place to another, answering ads and meeting people. I was getting more and more discouraged. One day, a member said, "Dave, why don't you apply at the aircraft factory? I know a fellow there who could help you." So that was where I got my first job. There really is a higher power looking after us.
One of the most fundamental things I have learned is to pass on our message to other alcoholics. That means I must think more about others than about myself. The most important thing is to practice these principles in all my affairs. In my opinion, that is what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. I never forget a passage I read in the copy of the big book that Bobby sent me. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. It is very simple, though not always easy, but it can be done.
Although the fellowship of AA doesn't offer any guarantees, but I also know that in the future, I do not have to drink. I want to keep this life of peace, serenity, and tranquility that I have found. Today, I have found again the home I left and the woman I married when she was still so young. We have two more children, and they think their dad is an important man. I have all these wonderful things, people who mean more to me than anything in the world. I shall keep all that, and I won't have to drink if I remember one simple thing: to keep my hand in the hand of God.
Thank you so much to everyone who read. I'd like to welcome Cara to the group. Welcome, Cara.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and thank you so much. I am Cara, compulsive overeater, recovering bulimic and sugar addict. And I would just like to say the Serenity Prayer before I begin. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. I'm really just incredibly grateful to be here today, and I just will give a quick qualification and then share my experience with today's topic of gratitude. So besides not ever having a normal relationship with food, I was always looking for something outside myself to make me happy. And I could relate to the author's statement that alcohol became my everyday companion. It turned out to be much more powerful than I was, even if for many years I could stay sober for short periods. That resonated with me because food and compulsive food behaviors was my drug of choice. And at an early age, I used it as my anti-anxiety drug. It was my friend, it was my lover, I made it my higher power. And throughout my life, I was a chronic dieter. And it was far more powerful than I was. And I could stay sober for short periods of time. You know, I was very good at losing weight. I just wasn't very good at keeping it off. And, you know, I've played around with bulimia. I've vomited. I've taken laxatives or an excess of fiber pills. I've exercised past the point of exhaustion. I've tried starvation, surgery. I've eaten past the point of fullness. I've been, you know, pacing the floor, passed out in a carb coma, ashamed, demoralized after every episode, regardless of whether I was restricting or overeating. It was just an incredibly lonely existence. And at my heaviest, I was just under 300 pounds. I'm only 5'1". So at my heaviest, you know, there's just a lot of body mass on a 5'1" frame when you are nearly 300 pounds. My thinnest weight got me hospitalized. And in my mind, you can never be thin enough. And that moment of thinness only lasted a nanosecond. But the point that I want to hit home was that I was malnourished regardless of what I weighed. So I realized today that I was starving for something that takeout just can't provide. And what I wanted cannot be found in a box, a bottle, a batch, a bin, a bucket. It's just not there. And I was longing for this deeper nourishment that I absolutely could not name. And I never listened to my body. I listened to what a celebrity told me to eat or what the latest craze was or the fad diet. And in my early 20s, I came to OA. Overeaters Anonymous was known to me by a college chum who was going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, "Do you know that there's a program for people who eat like I drink?" And so I started attending OA, and all I was hoping for was the right diet. I was looking for the external solution for the internal problem. And honestly, I had no desire to be among you people. You were all very nice, but just a little bit crazy. And honestly, when I walked into the halls, I felt like everyone was the age of my parents. You know, I found nothing relatable to these people in the rooms. I had no interest in attending meetings. I had better things to do with my time, certainly had no need to work the steps or growing my spirituality. So I lost some weight and then I left the program. And what I have learned in the field research that I've done in the years after that first foray into OA was that I don't just have an eating disorder, I have a living disorder. I have maladaptive coping skills and this distorted thinking, this peculiar mental twist, as the big book calls it. And I didn't know that the beliefs I had influenced my behavior with food. And quite honestly, most of my beliefs were false. Even though I would have told you I was very self-aware, I would have told you I was a very intelligent woman, I would have told you all of these things, but I did not have a clue. I did not know what I didn't know. And I believed all the lies of this disease. You know, the chatter in my head that never went away. This constant conversation about how I'm going to get my food, how I'm going to get rid of my food, where I'm going to hide my food, when I'm going to eat my food, what I'm going to eat. Will I feel guilty afterwards? And I just kept thinking, I can do this on my own. I don't need anybody's help. I just need a little more willpower. And then every time I'd go on a diet and, you know, starting on a Monday, by the time Friday rolled around, the food was no match. I lost every time. And then I'd say, there goes my willpower. And then I'd manage to punish myself with condemnation and more dieting. But I will tell you, and I say this all the time, I say this to my sponsees, no lasting change ever comes from self-loathing or harsh criticism. It just doesn't. It can't. Recovery cannot be found in punishment. But I didn't know that. So I continued to diet. I continued to struggle with my weight. As I said, ballooning up to almost 300 pounds. Depression, food obsession, sugar addiction. This went on for many, many, many more years. And I often say, celebration or sorrow, love or loss, I use food to navigate life. I was constantly restless, irritable, and discontent. And I also joke by saying, if you have the illustrated version of the big book, when you turn to page 52 and read about those bedevilments, you will see my picture next to those bedevilments. Because I had every reason to be happy, except I wasn't happy. I was miserable. And the author of today's reading, you know, also admitted to a strong inferiority complex, loneliness, feeling sorry for himself, this level of depression, despair. A hallmark of my disease is self-pity. Self-pity and misery. Nothing made me content. Not with food, not without the food, not even at my goal weight, not even getting below my goal weight, not even when I was in the hospital and thought, hey, I've made it. I hadn't made it. I remained in the throes of my addiction, and it had a stronghold on me, not just physically. Physically, I had a morbidly obese body with an addiction to sugar, but I was such a hopeless case. Like, it affected me mentally, emotionally, spiritually. My body, yes, was unhealthy, but my mind, friends, my mind was unhinged. And then in October of 2008, for reasons I can only explain as a God-inspired idea, I decide I'm going to go back to OA. And so I went to I live in Region 6. So I went to a Region 6 convention that took place in Plymouth, Massachusetts. And I was going to day trip it on the Saturday. And I was planning on driving, and the day of, I did not feel like going. There were better things I could do with my time, like eat. But I paid for the convention, so I did what I always did. I packed a big tote bag full of candy, because as a sugar addict, this was like my cocaine, and I freebased it. I mean, I basically just mainline sugar. And so I would carry pounds and pounds of junk food, mostly sugar, in a huge tote bag. And so I show up at this OA convention with contraband, and I'm there just in time for a newcomers meeting. And my God has such a sense of humor, because I didn't consider myself a newcomer. I had been to OA before. I had lost a little bit of weight, but I thought to myself, something in me said, go to this newcomer meeting, because it's been like 16 years since you had been to OA. I'm sure things have changed.
So anyway, that's 10.
Thank you.
Just so you know.
Thanks, Debbie. So the long story short is, I go into the meeting and I listen to a woman share on this workshop about for a newcomer, basically what OA is, that it's not just a physical problem that we have, that it really is spiritual and mental, emotional for us. And, you know, I admitted my powerlessness that day. I got on my knees. I prayed. I said the most heartfelt prayer I've ever said. And I get emotional every time I think about it, because I just looked up at the ceiling and I said, God, I can't do this anymore. I need your help. And so when I surrendered to this addiction to a power greater than myself, I got a sponsor. I went to meetings. This was the end of October. I got abstinent 4 days before Halloween. Now, I don't know what it's like for you guys, but in the United States, that's a high holy day for me. You know, like free candy. My sponsor said to me, how's that working for you? Because I begged her, can we please start this on November 1st? And she said, how is that working for you? And I got honest and I said, it's not. So I've been abstinent 1 day at a time since October 27th, 2008. And that is a miracle, because I couldn't string together 15 hours, let alone 15 years. I couldn't string together 15 days. If I went 2 weeks and lost 3 pounds, then it was like, whoo, I lost 3 pounds. That means I can go eat whatever I want. It was always this game I was chasing. And, you know, regardless of whether I was eating or restricting, and I've said this before, there was just such dissatisfaction in life. I will tell you, my recovery is only possible because I work the steps to the best of my ability, which includes developing a relationship with the God of my understanding, but also because I practice gratitude today. And, you know, I gave you the Reader's Digest version, and it sounds like such a, you know, easy journey, and that it was absolutely miraculous. And it is miraculous. It's absolutely miraculous. But it hasn't been without challenges. And over the years, I've experienced some health issues, death of family and friends, including the woman that led that workshop that I got really close to, the breakup of my marriage. There were job losses and just the day-to-day stuff that disappoints me, that inconveniences me, that discourages me. But it's never been a reason or an excuse to overeat. Because I promise you, no matter what you weigh, celebration or sorrow, love or loss, you are all going to experience something in life. You know, there aren't a lot of guarantees, but that I can guarantee, you will experience something. And I'll say, you know, you'll wait in lines, your car will break down, or your computer will stop, or you'll be talking on a Zoom and think you're unmuted and you're actually on mute. You will, you know, go to work and your boss won't recognize just how fabulous you are. Your skin will sag, you will get older, your children will move away, your loved ones will die. But none of those things can be fixed with food. None of that can be fixed by restricting or punishing yourself or overeating or putting fingers down your throat or overexercising. Can't be found in a bottle, a batch, a bin, a box. It's just not there. In program, I had to learn willingness. I had to cultivate this relationship with the God of my understanding, not the God of my childhood, not the God that all my friends believed in, not the God that my mother worshiped, my God, my higher power. And in the midst of every challenge, anything life can throw at me, I can find something, one thing to be grateful for. That is what keeps me abstinent. And I heard early on in program that a grateful heart doesn't abuse food. A grateful heart doesn't overeat. A grateful heart doesn't restrict. A grateful heart doesn't have that chatter in the head about what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's bad. It's not a moral issue. We're not bad people trying to get good. We're sick people just trying to get better. So I needed to adopt this attitude of gratitude. And I needed the God of my understanding to help me with that, because there were days when I don't feel like it. I recognize that there's a lot of crap going on in the world and even just in my house. But I'm always at a crossroads. I can go on eating compulsively, or I can surrender. And either way, I'm going to be uncomfortable. When I'm at this crossroads, I have to ask myself, what is it I really want? And I encourage you to just ask yourselves that. Like, what do I want? What do I really want in this moment? Because chances are, it's not food. I mean, unless you've restricted for the last 2 weeks or 2 days or 2 hours, then maybe it is food. But then maybe that's not a healthy relationship you need to have. And for me, the gratitude is recognizing that I'm at this crossroads and I need to make a decision based on what God's will is for me. And this attitude of gratitude is really more than just an attitude, it's an action. Service helps me get out of my head. That's why I'm here today. You know, that's precisely what the fellow did in our story. He says, I was thinking about somebody else instead of myself. And there's a line that's something like, I don't know, I'd begun to get a little bit of something I had never known before. And that was gratitude. And he goes on to say that the most fundamental thing he learned is to pass on that message of recovery to others and to practice the principles in all his affairs. When I'm useful to God and others, I alleviate my propensity toward depression, toward self-pity, toward maladaptive food behaviors. Early on in my recovery, people extended their hand and heart. To extend the hand and heart of OA to all who share our compulsion, for this we are, I am responsible. They gave of their time. They walked me through the steps. They taught me about the tools. Explained to me that the steps are for to save me from suicide. The traditions are to save me from homicide. You know, like I needed to learn that. They told me that they would love me until I could learn to love myself. I do service today because of the help I got early on in my recovery. Countless members were there for me. So I want to be there for others. It is the best way I know to express gratitude. It's my way of saying, thank you, God. One of the greatest acts of service, I believe, is carrying the message, how I live my life today. And that includes staying abstinent. And the service we perform, I believe, I truly, truly believe this. As sure as I am sitting here, I believe it comes back to us tenfold. The promises come true. And it gets returned to us with other bonuses of recovery. We're compensated with feelings of serenity, constructive, creative ideas, positive actions. I am blessed with a newfound understanding of God. And the grace to rely on that power to help me one day at a time. And you know, something else that I've heard in program, I used to hear it early on. I don't hear it so much anymore, but some of the older women would say, and don't forget to do service. Service is slimming. And I remember thinking, that sounds ridiculous. But you know, there is some truth in that. Because if we believe that adage, that service is slimming, I've discovered I will have solid, robust physical health. I'm at a suitable body weight. I have renewed energy. I am rewarded with a fellowship and friendships that are indescribable, amazing, life-giving. Some of my closest friends are in this fellowship. And one of my favorite lines from the AA Big Book is found on page 89. It's in the chapter Working with Others, which is code for doing service. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. And I also like to say, remember that we are ill. You know, I'm not anybody's counselor. I'm not their mother. I'm just another fellow. I'm just another bozo on the bus, as we hear. Then the paragraph goes on to say, and this packs a lot of punch for me, life will take on new meaning. Like, mind blown. My life has new meaning today. Then it says, to watch a people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish. Remember I said to you, compulsive eating is a really lonely pastime? Like, I wouldn't be with you folks today. I would be sitting on my couch with all my binge foods on the coffee table, binging, purging, that ping pong until I had passed out. That's a lonely existence. That's a very shameful place to be. So to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. And then it goes on to say, this is an experience you must not miss, or you won't want to miss. We know you won't want to miss it. It's like, no, I don't want to miss it. So tell me, what do I do? And I remember seeing that joy in other people's faces, that light, that effervescence, and being like, oh my God, could you just bottle this for me? Does it come in a pill? Because I'll take it. And they said, no, it doesn't. Comes in the form of a higher power. Comes in the form of practicing gratitude and doing service. You want recovery? You want continued sustainable abstinence? Access to the secret to OA? Do service. Trust God. Practice gratitude. So simple, but not easy. Not easy. And the thing is, you know, I can't dismiss the fact that working the steps isn't in there. All I said was do service, trust God, practice gratitude. Working the steps, nah, living the steps. You can work the steps, but I don't buy that. I want to encourage my sponsees and the newcomers I work with, newcomers, old timers, seasoned, whatever, members, I want you to live the steps. I want all of us to practice these principles in all our affairs. So do service. How do you do service? What is the message? You can figure that out. It's abstinence. It's working the steps. It's putting out chairs. It's hosting. It's chairing. It's moderating. It's speaking. It's showing up. Everybody that showed up here today is doing service. Don't discount that. Do service, trust God, practice gratitude. I truly have a life that is second to none, which does not mean that I don't have problems, because I do. I am very human. So if I have your consent to be fully human, I could talk for another 20 minutes on all the problems I have, but I don't. I have a life beyond my wildest dreams, because I'd rather focus on the solution, on the gratitude than on the problem. The Big Book also says, if we follow the dictates of a higher power, we will live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what our present circumstances are. A life beyond our wildest dreams. I want to keep this life of serenity, just like the man in that story. I want to keep all these wonderful things. I have so much in my heart right now. My hope, I guess, is that everybody here that's on this call or that's listening to this recording can find God's grace in the gift of gratitude. I journal and I keep a journal. I do a 10th step every night and I write a gratitude list every morning. That is part of my routine. It keeps me focused. I've been given so much in recovery. The OA 12 and 12 says, those of us who live this program don't simply carry the message, we are the message. So I just want to close by thanking you all for letting me do this service today. I truly mean it when I say I am grateful to have been able to share my experience, strength, and hope with you this day. And for the reminder to reflect on the wonderful things I've been given in recovery so that I don't forget what my higher power and this fellowship has done for me. And I wrote a prayer that I would like to read to you. I want to bring it up. I'd like to just close with this prayer. Higher power, as our recovery continues to unfold, grant us a heart of gratitude. May we see this practice as a better way to live, that the help we have received can be repaid by carrying the message. Help us give to others, both in and out of the fellowship, what we have so generously been given. We pray for inner strength and wisdom to practice the principles of this way of life in all we do and say. We pray most humbly to continue on the road of spiritual progress. We acknowledge need for you and other members in the program. We remain grateful always and thank you for the many blessings in our lives. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you again, friends.
Thank you so much, Cara, for your experience, strength, and hope. We will now be transitioning into a question and answer segment, and I'd like to introduce Mickey, who will be our moderator today. Thank you, Mickey.
Hi, I'm Mickey, compulsive overeater, and thank you so much, Cara, for your wonderful share of experience and strength and hope. And I am so grateful to be here to hear it. I'm also serving as the moderator today. You can send your questions in the chat to me if you'd like. And we're asking questions on gratitude in action or whatever you got from Cara's talk, and we're going to try to get through as many questions as we can today. First question is, Cara, how have you developed new coping skills for life?
How have I developed? Little by slow. I would say the biggest action that I took was, first of all, for me personally, I needed to get abstinent. I needed to put my food down to clear the fog in my head. That was paramount for me. But it was working with my sponsor and going through the steps. really, really looking at my behavior, the kinds of things that I did. So it really started to, again, I thought I was so self-aware, but I really started to unpack the mosaic of me during my fourth step. And realizing, and even, you know, so that was, this isn't part of the question, but I think it's important to know, if you've ever done a fourth step, and if you haven't, don't get worried. My sponsor said to me, oh, and, you know, God willing, this will be the first of many fourth steps that you do. And I thought, oh God, I don't want to do this again. It's hard enough the first time around. But I will tell you, every few years, I feel my higher power giving me like another little tap because I'm at a new place. So I feel this sort of gentle nudge every 5 to 7 years when I feel like I need to go through it again. Now, have I uncovered huge chunks about myself? Yes. Do I need to do a boatload of amends? No. But as I begin to understand more and more about my behavior and the motivation that underlies it, the need for food to help me cope becomes less and less. It's miraculous. It really, really is. If it works, if you work it, and you're worth it, so work it.
Thank you. Our next question is, you said recovery cannot be found in self-loathing and punishment. Can you talk more about how you recovered from self-loathing? There seems to be a big challenge for the person who asked the question.
Yeah. I don't know if I'll ever be recovered from that harsh critic that lives in my head. She is relentless. But I've learned to make friends with her. I've named her. So my name is Kara, which means beloved, or dear, it means dear or beloved in Italian. My father used to call me cara mia. The name Mara means bitter in Hebrew. So Mara is that self-critic in my head. Mara is the self-loathing. And she lives inside me too. I just tell her to kindly sit down. Thank you for making yourself known to me. I understand you're trying to protect me. Because what I also learned in my fourth step, when I started uncovering these shortcomings, these character defects, and I don't like to call them defects, I like to call them character defenses, because these were my protection. These were guards that I put up or behaviors that I embodied to protect little Kara. And so how do I put aside the self-loathing, the self-criticism with a whole lot of self-compassion? I say, thank you, Mara. Thank you for trying to protect me, for reminding me that maybe that food or that food behavior used to bring some comfort to me. I know that probably would taste really good right now, and I know you might want it, but it would be far more punishing to consume it and then try to get rid of it or diet than to be at that crossroads and say, I'd rather be uncomfortable in abstinence and in self-compassion than in punishment and dieting and overeating. And sometimes, even today, I will have to talk myself through that, just like I did. Sometimes I'll have to cry my way through it. But you're not alone. And that's another huge reminder, is I thought I had to do this on my own, and I don't. So when That voice comes up and Mara is loud and stamping her feet like a toddler. I make an outreach call. And I ask myself, what is it you really want? And as I said to you, chances are it's not food. Could be a hug. Could be someone just to tell me I'm okay. And I bet you dollars to donuts that each of us here on this Zoom has felt that somewhere deep in our hearts. I'm just guessing, because I'm pretty sure most of you are human here. Thanks.
Thank you so much. One of the other questions is, what is the one thing you would want to tell a newcomer before they leave their first meeting?
Yeah. It's not just one thing. It's keep coming. Attend at least 6 different meetings because they're all a little different. Some are literature meetings, some are speaker meetings, some combine both, some are step study. You'll find something, hopefully, in each of them. But most importantly, keep coming so we can love you until you learn to love yourself. That's what I kept hearing. And I was like, I didn't love myself. And I'm thinking, I've got these people fooled, but I'll keep coming because it feels awfully nice for somebody to say that they will love me. Yeah, that's what I would say. And then I would just ask if they're open to hugs, because I would just want to throw my arms around them and give them a hug.
Thank you. We still have some time left, so please continue to send your questions. The next question I have that I received was, first of all, thank you for your share. Could you tell us more about your concept of higher power and how you step into contact with it, and how do you see its signs or indicators that it's there?
That's a great question. You know, our higher powers are so personal, and I really believe that. So I call my higher power God. You can call your higher power whatever you want. For convenience, I just use God, and that is the term that I had growing up. But when I was younger, I grew up with a religion, and there were rituals surrounding that religion. What I've been taught is to cultivate a relationship. And so, yes, so today I still have a religion. I still have rituals around that religion, but it's a relationship. I talk to God as I'm talking to you. And I generally kind of look up at the ceiling. I don't believe God has a gender. I don't believe God is male or female. I believe that God embodies just love. I believe God is powerful, more powerful than me, clearly. I believe God is giving and forgiving. And on any given day, like if you ask me 2 days from now, I might tell you that my concept is very different. Like I might use some of those same adjectives, but I might say, oh my God, you is so funny today because this happened. And because I'm a very creative person, so I'm an artist and a writer and an educator, I see God in just about anything. You know, like I will walk outside and I will see a sunset, and I will say out loud every time, thank you, God. Thank you for painting that just for me. And if I'm with other people and I say it out loud, as I just told you I do, other people go, what? And I go, no, God painted that just for me. And chances are God knew that you were going to be here with me, so you can say it was for you too. It doesn't matter. Like, that's how I see God manifest. Just the fact that I'm sitting here at a healthy body weight, that's a sign for me. You get to decide what those signs are. It's your higher power.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Some other questions? We still have a few. What did you do when food called to you? When the food called to you?
And make no mistake, it still does. It absolutely does. It's not like it takes a vacation. I just stop and I say, okay, I'm at a crossroads. I could eat that thing. I weigh and measure my food because that's what keeps me safe. Some people may say, well, that's a little too restrictive for me. I don't want that. That's your recovery then. I had to get honest with myself. It's not that I use a food scale because I'm dieting. No, I just need parameters around my food so that I don't eat too much and I don't eat too little, because that's the range that my disease manifested. I don't know what your disease is, but regardless, when the food calls, I think it through. Think, pray, then act. I don't act first, which is what I used to do. Like, oh my God, that looks so good and somebody made it for me, or it's my birthday, or fill in the blank. I need to have it. No, I say, you know what? Thank you, God. Here's where the gratitude comes in. Thank you that I don't need that today to fit in to this party or this occasion or this season. Thank you, God, for reminding me that, yeah, for many people, that looks like a delicious option. For me, it's not. And just for today, I ask you for the strength to just give me the willingness to make a phone call to say, hello, I'm ready to eat anything that's not nailed down. Can you talk me through it? And, you know, my grand sponsor used to say, pray, breathe, and drink some water. That's how you'll get through it.
Thank you. Along with that question, another one that was similar, which was, you shared about joining or rejoining OA prior to Halloween. What made you come back the next day or call or reach out? What convinced you to stay?
You know, I think it was a gift of desperation. I will also share that when I came back, I was not at my heaviest. I had lost some weight. I was, instead of being just under 300 pounds, I was just under 200 pounds. I was 196, which again is really overweight for someone who's on a 5'1" frame. But I was so desperate and just so miserable. Restless, irritable, and discontent. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Thank
and
you.
People were so nice.
Thanks. There is a passage in the big book, this is another question, that talks about in this drama of life. It's on page 62. What are your thoughts about that?
All of life is a drama. You know, you're talking to someone who did her undergraduate in theater. So yeah, I was always the actor. There's always drama if I choose it. I go back to the, you know, also on that page or in that chapter about, you know, in this drama of life. I find it here. You know, this whole idea of I've taken step three at this point. So I turn my life and my will over to the care of God as I understand God. So what does that mean? That sounds so highfalutin. I turn my will and my life, and that was explained to be as being my thoughts and my actions. You know, I used to be like, I want what I want when I want it, and I can't wait. It's all impulse. And now it's like, okay, I'm going to stop with the self-centeredness. I'm going to stop with the self-delusion, the self-pity, all of that. And, you know, it's relying, it's just doing things differently. Change one small, make one small shift. I used to say this to some of my sponsees too. Make one small shift, get up, move a muscle, change a thought. That's what happens. Like, don't just sit there, get up, stand up, do some jumping jacks. Like the drama, how is it in the big book? Like it's of our own making, troubles are of our own making. There's going to be drama. It's just, do you want the drama to be 30 minutes or do you want it to be, you know, a series? It can be a sitcom or it can be, you know, a soap opera and go on for years. I hope I answered that question.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your answer. There are more questions. You said a grateful heart doesn't have moralizing and judging chatter going on in your head. What does that look like for you in terms of your day-to-day actions?
Yeah, so it's not that the judgment is not going to come up. Of course it's going to come up. Like our brains are meant to think critically. That's what we all went to school for, is to think, be critical thinkers. I guess what I really mean is, once we recognize the thought, like, oh, I'm being kind of harsh with myself, or I'm being sort of judgy about someone else, I can step back and say, again, I just bring it right down to gratitude. Thank you, God, for pointing out that I recognize sort of the judginess of it. And now, can I be grateful for something else? Can I look to something else so that I'm out of me and my head? How can I put this attitude of gratitude into action? Okay, it's service of others. You know, sometimes I'm going to go back to the question about the food calling. Sometimes if I'm having an especially hard day, either food is calling or, you know, whatever, work was awful or I'm feeling unlovable, whatever, I might pick up the phone and ask how someone else is. Like, forget about me. I'm done thinking about me for today. So the gratitude is, thank God I have a tool called the telephone where I can pick up and I have an action plan that reminds me that these things are available to me and that I have a whole host of friends in fellowship, that there are phone numbers out there, that I am not alone. And then sometimes I'll like look around my apartment and say, yeah, thank God I have an apartment. And if your apartment sucks, thank God, you know, it's not leaking today or whatever. Like, I guarantee you, if you find it, you can find the one small thing. And I get angry with God too. You know, like, I can't find anything to be grateful for today, God, so there. You know, and I sit with that for a little bit. Doesn't mean that I'm not going to have these feelings wash over me from time to time. But if I do it with regularity, as I said, my daily practice is to write that gratitude list every day. And nearly every day, warm showers is on my gratitude list. And it's getting old, but I'm grateful for warm showers, you know? And then because I do it long enough, some days when there's nothing to be grateful for, I go, well, at least I took a warm shower today. It gets easier.
Thank you. There's a couple more questions left. We have about 10 more minutes left. How do you find balance giving to others out of gratitude and your own self-care?
That is a really fantastic question. I don't. I struggle. I give a lot of service, and this past week, I gave too much service and could feel myself getting burnt out a little bit, projecting. You know, if I think about the past too much, I sit in depression and self-pity. If I think too far ahead in the future, I get anxious and worried and start, it's what I call the blender brain. And that's where I kind of was earlier in the week, like, oh my God, how am I going to finish everything? And I've got this for this meeting and that for region and this for world service and that for this and this person and my sponsees and blah, 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 and I got to call my sponsor and I got to make my food and chop the lettuce and breathe. I overcommitted myself last week, just a little. And I said, all right, Kara, you did it again. I didn't say, see, you did it again. You're a loser. You'll never get this right. No, I said, you did it again. But you know what, darling? You're going to get through it. And it probably is not going to be so bad. And you know what? If you have to, you tell them. So I had like back-to-back meetings that I was doing service on. And one of them, I said, I really need to log off 15 minutes prior to the hour because I need to decompress so I can get ready for my next service commitment. The meeting lasted a half an hour. I had a 30 minutes to decompress. It was like, God does it for me. It's like, I get to enjoy all these things. You can be sure that the following day, what was on my gratitude list? Thank you for giving me a half an hour. Thank you for giving me the wherewithal to ask for 15 minutes, but for giving me 30 so that I could prep some of my dinner, take a break, do some deep breathing, collect my notes for the next meeting. I don't find that balance to be an easy thing to navigate. But I don't know anybody that does it perfectly. I think it's all a little bit of trial and error. As long as it's not trial by fire, I think we're all doing okay.
Thank you so much. And I do have one more question for you. Dave B. talks about practicing the AA principles in all his affairs. How do you make sure you're practicing the AA principles in all your affairs?
So one of the things I really love about the newer AA 12 and 12, the second edition, is that it lists the principles, you know. So step one, the spiritual principle is honesty. Step two is hope. Step three is faith. Step four is courage. Step five is integrity, and on and on and on. Each month, you know, I go to different meetings. And I mean, each week I go to different meetings, but each month, generally, because there's 12 months and there's 12 steps, we'll talk about a particular step. So we're in the third month. We're talking a lot about, in many of my meetings, step three. I will probably, in any meeting, read step three, either out of the big book, out of the AA 12 and 12, out of the OA 12 and 12, a minimum of two times. So I'm getting this whole notion of faith and what it's like to live by simply putting my faith in this higher power that I choose to call God, turning my will and my life over to the care. What does that look like? Okay, God, I'm trusting you that when I weighed my cereal this morning, it looked pretty, and the bowl looked pretty empty. I'm hoping that it fills me today. Like, to me, that's a walk in faith. That's turning my will and my life over to the care of God. It's okay, God, I don't know what's going to happen with my son on the spectrum, but I know that he is also one of your children. I put my faith in you that you will iron out his life. I don't have to manage that today. So how do I practice those principles? I look at those words, and I try to embody them within that month. Now, does that mean that because we're in month three and it's faith, that I'm not going to practice perseverance or service because those are in steps 10 and 12 respectively. No, it just means that there's special attention that I might give to a particular principle based on the month that we're in or a season of life that I'm in. There was last year, I needed to have an awful lot of courage in a lot of things that I did. And I felt like that was what I was walking through, was faith and courage last year. Those were the two words that really carried me through.
Thank you so much. There did pop up one more question. We have a question was, how did you give yourself to your higher power?
You know, I really feel like it happened in that moment when I got on my knees after that newcomer meeting. I quickly grabbed my tote bag, hoping the candy wasn't spilling out. And I slung it over my shoulder and was making a beeline for the door when the workshop leader stopped me. She put her hand on my arm and she said, hi, I'm Gail. And I said, hi, I'm Kara. Thank you. Thanks so much. And she said, would you like to pray with me? And I'm not saying that everybody has these kind of moments, these experiences. I wanted these kind of experiences, but I couldn't have written the script for this. But I prayed with her. And as I said, I got on my knees, which is just such a humble position to be in. And it's not the first time I'd ever been on my knees before, but there was just something in that moment, something in the vulnerability that this woman allowed me to just say out loud, I need your help, God. So, yeah, in many ways, I could say I was struck abstinent, or, you know, I had that spiritual experience or awakening that is, you know, the thunder, the music, and other people have the slow educational variety. I may have had that big bang moment in that kneeling, but everything else has been slow and very educational. And there is no, there's no right or wrong way. There's just your way, my way, and however God chooses to work and manifest in your life and in my life.
Thank you so much. 10 minutes to the hour. And our Q&A time has come to an end, and I hand the meeting back over to Debbie B.
Thank you. Thank you, Mickey, and thank you so much, Kara. Okay, our seventh tradition. According to our seventh tradition, we are fully self-supporting through our own contributions. As we have now moved to virtual meetings, it is important that we continue to be fully self-supporting. This allows Overeaters Anonymous to continue to carry the message to those that still suffer. You are able to send your donations through our website at www.ad4l.info. For those of you able to see the Zoom chat, the link will also be posted there. Thank you all for your support. It is appreciated. Next meeting, a reminder that A Design for Living Big Book OA is a daily meeting. We are based out of Melbourne, Australia. The recording from today's workshop will be available from our website, where you can also find out about other upcoming events and speakers. Visit our website at www.ad4l.info. Our next monthly speaker series will be held on April 14th, and the topic will be The Missing Link. We hope to see you there. Closing. In closing, I would like to thank you all for your service in coming here today. By following the 12 steps, attending meetings regularly, and using the OA tools, we are changing our lives. You will find hope and encouragement in Overeaters Anonymous. To the newcomer, we suggest attending at least 6 different meetings to learn the many ways OA can help you. The opinions expressed here today are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. Please remember our commitment to honor each other's anonymity. What you hear here, whom you see here, when you leave here, let it stay here. Let us all reach out by phone or email to newcomers, returning members, and each other. Together we get better. To close the meeting, could Richard please unmute and read the promises? Thank you, Richard.
The promises. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.